Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 86 of Registry Matters. Larry, we got a guest tonight. Why don't you do a quick little introduction for Ashley, and then we'll poke around with some stuff, and then we'll do some more formal introductions.
All right. Well, Ashley is the new staff attorney for the Liberty and Justice Coalition, which is the New Mexico affiliate of NARSOL. And Ashley is a former assistant district attorney with the 13th Judicial District Attorney's Office who recently left to pursue criminal defense work. She's going to be specializing in sex offender cases. She spent the better part of her entire 25-year legal career as a prosecutor in New Mexico. As a prosecutor, she held positions as felony DWI supervisor, arson division supervisor, and supervisor of the DA clinical program. During her time at the 2nd and the 13th district attorney's offices, she prosecuted and tried numerous cases, including child sex crimes, murder, property crimes, drug crimes, domestic violence, escape from jail, arson, and DWIs. Ms. Cloud has also practiced law in domestic relations, criminal defense, white collar, and bankruptcy law. And she's going to be with us at the Liberty Justice Coalition, and she's going to be engaged in a private practice of law. And we're just so glad to have Ashley, and she's going to be with us for at least an hour tonight. And thank you, Ashley.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So, Larry, how are you? It's Saturday night, and you got any party plans after the podcast?
I don't have any party plans. I'm still in a little bit of pain, so I'm hoping that I can get through this podcast before my old age catches up with me. Remember, yikes. I go back to the Lincoln administration.
The Lincoln administration. Are you that old, Larry?
Pretty much, yes.
And Ashley, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
I'm good. I'm a little bit younger than the Lincoln administration, but not much.
Not much. See, I'm thinking you're more close to my age, which is only like somewhere around Methuselah and dirt.
And that eon, yeah.
All right. Very good.
I think she goes back to the Teddy Roosevelt administration.
Wow. All right. So everybody here on this call tonight is ancient history. Why don't we dive right into the late breaking news, Larry, and I will give you the honors of this one.
Well, we have some news out of the state of Arkansas. The General Assembly, Arkansas Legislature, has passed an Act 463, which has become effective, and it will prohibit Level 3 and Level 4 sex offenders in that state from engaging in wearing costumes and basically involving themselves in Halloween activities. And it's unfortunate, but that will be a new state that's added to the Halloween restriction list this year.
Who are the Level 3s and 4s?
In Arkansas, they go through a process at the Sex Offender Assessment Board in Pine Bluff, and that would be people who have been individual risk assessed as the highest risk offenders. And it didn't say it in the Act, but I think they have also a sexually violent predator designation that they can put on people. And if it applies to Level 3s and 4s, it stands to reason it would apply to the sexually violent predators, although I didn't see that in the Act.
Okay. Just curious. All right, so Ashley,
did you get a chance to look at that Act and have any comments about it?
I did, actually. I share the same opinion that you do, Larry, that they did a really good job, unfortunately for us, of narrowly tailoring that so that it just applies to Level 3 and Level 4, and they're very specific on what behavior you can and cannot do, which is distributing candy, wearing a costume. And then they even enumerated exceptions for that. If they're your children, if you're working at a store, things like that. So they did a really good job of doing that, which makes it really difficult for us to challenge.
So, well, I know we're going to be looking at it on the NARSOL side, but when I saw that it had been narrowly tailored, I thought back on the decision out of Arkansas that related to the 2,000-foot residence restriction. They applied to Level 3 and 4, and that was taken up to the 8th Circuit. And the 8th Circuit said it's okay because they have had due process. It's an individualized determination. It's not a blanket prohibition. Therefore, it's okay. So I suspect that whatever panel this would go to on appeal, because I can't see the trial judge being favorable, when this goes up on appeal, that panel is not going to want to deviate from the previous panel's determination. So I'm not optimistic, but I certainly want us to look at it.
Right, absolutely. But no, I share the same opinion that you do, that this will be an uphill battle because of how they drafted it. But of course, as with a lot of things, we just won't automatically rule it out.
So, all right. Well, I know the Arkansas people worked as hard as they could to try to prevent this, but it apparently passed unanimously or near unanimously.
Do you want to jump into those the various cases that you're going to discuss with Ashley?
Absolutely. We're gonna look at some case decisions. And Ashley was on with us last week, and we talked about Gundy at considerable length. And it's always interesting to get a different perspective, or maybe a similar perspective. We'll find out. But that case is of one of such importance to our constituents and our supporters. And then there's a case just recently that we haven't had a chance to talk to, Snyder versus Indiana, and not to be confused with the Snyder case out of Michigan. This is a different circuit, a different state. And that case is just a stellar decision by a U.S. district judge in Indiana, dealing with out-of-state people who have out-of-state convictions who have moved to Indiana, or people who had Indiana convictions who left the state of Indiana and came back and all of a sudden found that they were subject to new requirements. So, Ashley, do you want to tackle one? What order do you want to go in? Do you want to deal with Gundy or Snyder?
Let's start with Gundy, Larry.
All right. Well, I've babbled about Gundy for a long time and heard what I think. So let's hear what you think.
So I tend to agree with you on Gundy. And I think the important thing for people to remember is that as we talk about Gundy, we are not endorsing the SORA registration. But what we're getting at is the way that they handled this case. And the way that they handled this case was essentially to leave the delegation in place so that each state could come up with their own set of rules and the attorney general could oversee that. They don't want to remove that power. And it has such wide, far-reaching consequences for a lot of other actions that we can kind of see why they're coming up with that mentality. Not necessarily that they're saying, yeah, these registrations are okay, but they're not going to remove that power. And we see that. And I think we discussed earlier that you foresee that there are going to be challenges in this area on other matters, but not necessarily on the sex offender registry again.
Well, I think that our guest last week, we talked about the delegation and how significant there is a coalition of organizations, including the Federalist Society, who want to see delegation of any type come to an end. And we saw in the alignment on Gundy with Alito saying that he was ready to join that coalition, but he wasn't going to stick his neck out on this particular issue. And we now have the Fifth Justice that presumably would give that majority. So I think I agree with our guest last week that it's just a matter of time. Do they grant cert? It only takes four to grant cert. So if you've got five votes, it stands to reason to me you can get four to get a case approved for review. But in terms of the issue before the court wasn't really whether a registration was constitutional or not. It was whether the delegation, and people kept focusing on all these amicus briefs that were coming from all the coalition partners who want to dismantle delegation, and they saw that as opposition to sex offender registration. It had nothing to do with opposition to sex offender registration. It had everything to do with their opposition to try to dismantle as much of the U.S. government as they possibly can. And that's what this is all about. They looked at delegation. I think you've written an article that's going to be published here in a couple, in less than 2 weeks, hopefully, for the Arsenal newsletter. And I think it, there's more detail about why the delegation was there, because we had these decisions of other states' Supreme Courts. By the time the Adam Walsh Act passed, which has the current SORNA, there had been numerous Supreme Court rulings, at least several around the country, that had held that retroactive application was violated that state's constitution. And therefore, the Congress was well aware that it was going to be tricky in terms of how to apply it to the states, whether they could elevate their requirements to match the newly suggested federal requirements. So they said, Mr. Attorney General, you figure this out. You work with the states and see which states you can get that can apply this. And we want as many states as we can, but we don't know. And also, the part that really confused people was he was prosecutor for traveling. He traveled from Maryland to New York. And at the time he traveled, there was a federal travel penalty. I think that was 2250, USC 18, USC 2250. But there was a prohibition against traveling, a federal prohibition against traveling and not registering with a new state. And to me, it's just mind-boggling that you would think that Congress would want the 100,000 missing sex offenders to have immunity to continue to be missing, and that the 400,000 that was registered at the time that the AWA passed in 06, that you would want to grant them the ability to travel without registering and be immune from prosecution. That just baffles my mind, and I saw that in the article. So I just don't understand what's confusing about that. Of course they wanted. Now, is the jurisdictional hook they used of the Commerce Clause a proper use of the Commerce Clause? That's a separate piece of litigation.
Yes, it is.
That's a very long stretch to get there. To say, well, an offender who goes across state lines from Maryland to New York has engaged in interstate commerce. Well, have they?
That's an interesting side note on the Commerce Clause, because that raises a whole host of issues. And there are, I'm sure you're familiar, in New Mexico, there's actually a group of people that claim that they don't enter into the stream of commerce. And I know that they're across the U.S., so that they're not subject to any law. And they claim that they're sovereign nations. I see that particular part of the analysis actually relating to the sovereign nationers.
Yes. Well, they were attempting to mimic the interstate flight to avoid prosecution. Now, since you spent years in prosecutions, you know exactly what happens. A person from New Mexico is out in Hawaii, and the feds bring the person back to New Mexico and hand them off to you and say, he engaged in interstate flight to avoid prosecution. They dismissed their federal prosecution, but they used their resources and their national jurisdiction to go anywhere, and they brought the person back. How often does one of those charges actually go through to fruition? But it is a charge that's filed fairly frequently when a person has left a jurisdiction, and then it's dropped when they're handed off to the local jurisdiction that they avoid prosecution in by engaging in interstate. That's what they were attempting to use, that same model, when they came up with this theory that interstate travel by a sexual offender is invoking the Commerce Clause. I think it's a stretch, but they can do it until they're stopped. And I don't think there's been any case, any appellate law that I'm aware of on point. On where the SORNA really is in interstate travel. And that doesn't mean I haven't missed it, but I'm not recollecting.
No, I'm not sure that there is any law on that either. And you're right. Until they're stopped, they'll keep doing it. But at this point, it seems like they want to leave that delegation right where it's at.
So we can't go back and redo Gundy. And I don't believe, even if they granted a cert on another non-delegation case, and they find that particular delegation inappropriate, I don't think it's going to alter Gundy at all, because Gundy has already been decided. And I don't think that they're going to look at Gundy and say it's distinguishable. That was different. This is now. That was then. I don't see it unwinding anything that they decided on Gundy.
I don't either. I think that that's pretty much the way that it's going to be.
So it may dismantle other aspects of the U.S. government. And I think people are really should be careful what they ask for, because if you want to dismantle delegation altogether, then a lot of things that you depend on from your federal government, you won't be able to have, because Congress can never move fast enough to make the alterations in the requirements to suit the needs of society. And I think I talked about it last week on the podcast about Social Security or veterans disability. Congress doesn't specify what the actual disabling condition is. They would never update those disability listings fast enough to evolve with. I mean, you look at statutes that go decades without. I mean, look at the $250 to $255 Social Security death benefit. I think that's been the death benefit for about 60 years now.
And are you saying that should be adjusted for inflation or something?
To me, if you're going to pay a death benefit to a person who's receiving benefits, it should approximate. At the time they did it, it would go a long ways towards paying for a funeral
right
of a Social Security recipient. But 60 years later, It doesn't pay for much. If you wanted the disability programs to work with congressional oversight, where they specified what was a condition that was disabling and what wasn't, and to evolve with clinical diagnostic interpretation and what we learn and new diseases that come along, you'd be waiting a very, very long time for your benefits. They have to delegate that process to administrative law judges and to people in the agency who have the expertise to run those programs within the spirit and intent of the program, which is to pay disability benefits to those who meet the eligibility requirements.
Hey, David in chat says it pays for a bouquet of flowers.
A cheap bouquet.
Well, they should either abolish it or they should adjust it, because $255 doesn't do very much.
Larry, are you suggesting that our government operates at less than a stellar pace?
I'm suggesting that society has become far more complex than it was in 1789. We have a lot more role that the government plays than they did in 1789. And most people appreciate that role, and they depend on that role. There's some things you don't love. If you're in business, you don't care too much about OSHA coming in, about your occupational safety. And if you're belching out pollution, you probably don't care a whole lot about the Environmental Protection Agency. But most people depend on the government in some way, shape, or form. They just don't realize it that they do. But every aspect of your life is impacted by government, federal, state, and local. And when you dismantle the ability of your government to operate, you're going to have a country that you're not going to be very fond of. And it's already very inefficient because it's become so complex throughout the centuries of change. You know, in 1789, the general welfare of the population didn't mean a whole lot in 1789, except for maybe trying to stop infectious disease. But in terms of the general welfare of society, has evolved immensely over the last 240 years. You know, a lot of things happened under the General Welfare Clause that never would have been thought of in 1789. But you like those things. You like the fact that your grandma is getting Medicare, and Social Security benefits, and not lined up with a tin cup waiting to be served a cup of soup because she has nowhere to live. You appreciate the evolving standards of decency and what we've done in terms of the where we were and where we are. Most people appreciate how government has evolved and the services. We don't like paying for them, but most people depend on some form of government service.
Larry, I would caution you, we did get some hate mail last week for being too partisan.
I haven't said a parson word tonight.
Oh.
So, okay. No political party has been mentioned. I'm talking about in terms of what government services provide and what Social Security is universally appreciated and supported. Now, there are people who try to convince folks that it won't be there and scare the hell out of them, that it's going broke and that they will never see a penny. But those people are misinformed, are being deliberately disingenuous, because Social Security, for it to cease to exist, would mean we would have to have no funding source, which would mean we would have to have nobody employed in the United States contributing into the system, because that's where the funding formula comes from, is from employer and an employee contribution. So if we're going to go to a completely automated society where no one is employed, then that might bankrupt Social Security. But Social Security will always have an income. It may not be enough to cover the benefits and the increasing population that's eligible for those benefits, but it will have an income for a long time to come.
Well, can we move on to this Snyder versus Indiana? I think this is the one that someone dropped on you maybe 3 weeks ago, and you just completely missed it, or something like that.
Didn't miss it. What I did was I saved it, downloaded it on my phone, and then I lost the email that I got it from, and I was intending to talk about it, but I couldn't find it. And today, when I had to send Ashley something that was an attachment, I said, lo and behold, there it is.
Just magically reappeared.
I was sending that attachment from my phone, and there was, of my recent files, there was the case. So I sent it to Ashley, and she's taken a look at it, and she's just has done a stellar review and has a lot to talk about. And then I'll jump in I've made some highlights in the PDF document. But what is Snyder about? Tell us what the issue was in Snyder.
So in Snyder, we had several people. What was it? Five people that they were doing a summary judgment on.
I believe it was five plaintiffs who had been convicted in other states. I think one had an Indiana conviction, if I remember right, but most of them had out-of-state convictions.
And what the beauty of this case is, and why it's so important to us, is these five people each had convictions that predated the SORA requirements in Indiana. In Indiana, if you predate those, you do not have to register. However, if you come from out of state, you have to register. Or if you commit the crime, get convicted in Indiana, leave the state, and then come back, then you have to register. So there's a huge discussion about equal protection here, which Larry and I were talking earlier, that would be the first one that would jump out at you, because you cannot make people that come from out of state have different requirements than the people that are within a state, because that would be like making people get a different type of driver's license or anything else that you require people to have when they come in from out of state. It'd be the same as the citizens within those borders. But the beauty of this case is that they don't just stop there. They go on to discuss the retroactive application of SORA, and then they go into this brilliant analysis of whether the registration is actually punitive, and they go step by step, all five steps of it, and have some amazing quotes on how paying the annual fee, having to go and take time off from work, if you have to register, if you're homeless in Indiana, you have to register every 7 days, how punitive this is. If you're being shamed because of what your type of crime is, and they go on to list that one of the people that is actually one of the plaintiffs has on the registry, it actually gives the details of their crime. So they go into this really good analysis of what makes a punitive registration, and they do a really good job of it. Then they even expand it into the right to travel and talk about leaving the state, coming back, or coming from out of state actually inhibits the freedom and fundamental right to travel. So there's a lot of good stuff in this case. And I think that this actually sets us up for some good challenges where we see this in other states. Larry, do you agree?
I agree with you completely. And I had highlighted that particular, this is 37 pages, so I'm scrolling through, but I had highlighted what they put on one of these registrants, what they described him to be, his offense. They presented it in the most awful way that you could imagine describing it. And that is like the court recognized that was deliberately done to shame. And then I looked at some of the arguments the state made. They even objected to the affidavits as being hearsay. Did you catch that part?
I did catch that. And the court was real. They made one line in reference to that and said, defendant statements are not hearsay. As if this was an annoyance. It was, like I said, it was brilliant. I love this case.
It's on page 27. The details, DLC posts the details of the crime, like criminal sexual conduct, first degree, with personal injury, engaged in sexual penetration, to wit, entered victim's vagina with penis, causing personal injury, and said, and using force or coercion to accomplish sexual penetration and bruising victim's thighs, sick hips, buttocks, arms, and victim was a friend of the family for 8 years. I guess they don't, when they put the sick, that means that they're stating it exactly as it was, even though it's grammatically incorrect. And
right.
Those were a whole bunch of words that you cannot use on a family broadcast.
They used them on the registry.
Oh my God, that's some graphic stuff. I mean, that's almost like reading Penthouse letters or something. Not that I've ever read those. I'm just saying.
You heard about them, and that's exactly what they did on this.
Wow.
Well. This decision that I have read a lot of opinions, and I don't think I can recall of one where the judge has shot the state down on every single thing. Could this be that the judge got irritated at the duplicitous arguments that they were making and the fact that they were opposing everything? Or could it be that this was just a fantastic judge that got it? Because sometimes I think judges get frustrated when they oppose everything. And that's what they did here. They couldn't agree. The state couldn't agree to anything.
And it's funny because the judge points out that it isn't just that they couldn't agree to anything. They didn't even give a reason why they didn't agree. They're basically just saying, oh, that's not the way it is. And that's exactly what the judge says. They gave no specific reason as to why the plaintiffs were wrong, just that they didn't like what they were saying.
So, well, they go through the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez seven factors. They only utilize five of those seven, but they go through those factors very eloquently, and they knocked the state down on bowling pins. They found, didn't they find all five of them to lean towards a putative? So they found every single factor.
Even one of them that they might have possibly found wasn't punitive. That's the one that you see in the shortest paragraph. I think it's only a couple of lines in the analysis. And even that one, they're like, yeah, this is still punitive. And they move on. They don't even give a good analysis, but they just shot him down. I've never seen that either.
Well, I would urge those legal beagles, and we have some that listen, to certainly look at the highlighted parts of the opinion. But as I've said for several years, Smith versus Dole is distinguishable. And they say that on page 28. The acting Smith merely published already public information on the internet about the offense and did not classify, label the offender. And then it says, nor did it restrict where offenders could move or live, which is something I've said for a long time. Here, SORA includes the details of the offense and permanently stigmatizes the offender. It also significantly impacts where the plaintiffs can reside and see their children. So courts actually will get the difference if you articulate the differences and the proper vehicle, proper cause of action, not through some haphazard put together appeal in a criminal case, but you actually do the right cause of action. They can actually give you the opportunity to build your evidentiary record to support this. These plaintiffs used the right vehicle. They put on evidence that showed how severely, I mean, they talked about how they couldn't go to their kids' play. I mean, one has got a six-year-old. He's completely, completely cut out of his kid's life for educational purposes.
Can I jump in?
Right.
There's an article on the NARSOL site that comes from Moberly Monitor Index that federal suit challenges sex offender registry. I don't want to jump the gun because this is at the end of the show, but there are a bunch of like families that have filed lawsuits against what the registry does to their families, you know, as collateral damage. Isn't this going down the same path?
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I love about this case is that those are the implications that we can make as a result of it. These are people that can't go to their kids' schools and watch their plays. They can't go see their sports. They can't be meaningfully involved in their kids' lives. On top of that, one of the plaintiffs, when they went to go to the Grand Canyon, they were ordered to give an itinerary of where they were going to be, what hotel they were going to stay at,
by
everything
whom?
Else. And we're not talking about by the sex offender registry. We're
in,
not even talking
Arizona
about probation.
Or Nevada?
In Indiana.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the source state required it. Okay. Yeah. But that, I mean, like, they're one of the crazy states, like one of the most aggressive ones anyway, I think.
So, well, another thing that the people who will really love, as I highlight on page 33 at the beginning, if anything, the evidence suggests that SORA may increase recidivism since most offenders recidivate due to technical violations.
Right.
And then they cited the source of that, but it was not the court saying that. It was Prescott and Joda, Rockoff, do sex offender notification laws affect? But the court took note of that in this opinion,
The court also took note of, I'm so glad you brought that up, Larry, because the court also took note of the fact that all these recidivism rates that are being thrown out there are incorrect and that it's actually a very low recidivism. And then even when you break that down, like you just stated, it's technical violations. And then they go on to make the statement that the registration is increasing those because they're causing the technical violations. So it's really well stated in terms of a breakdown and going on to be able to use that in other cases where you say, look, these recidivism rates that somebody said one time and it just kept getting copy and pasted over and over are not accurate. Here's a better breakdown.
But there, forgive me for chiming in again. Larry, you have said we should never go to the table. And I don't mean to say we should never, but you say that we shouldn't use those recidivism facts because the whole thing is unconstitutional. So we shouldn't use recidivism unless they want to bring it up because the whole 100 rounds in a Gatling gun, blah, blah, blah. And three of them are live. You want to be on the receiving end?
Absolutely. And the state of Indiana used that as an argument. And you have to combat their argument when they assert it. You can't just say, I choose to disregard that. But it's not the plaintiff's argument. It's the plaintiff who's moving for the declaration of unconstitutional, they need unconstitutionality. They need to be prepared to swat that down because the state will say recidivism is frightening and high. And then you say, Your Honor, it's not relevant if it is frightening and high because that doesn't determine the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors are in control here. But just since that's on the table, the recidivism is not frightening and high, and here's what it actually is. And you do the rebuttal, and you discredit them. And hopefully that helps impact the judge's determination. But you don't bring up recidivism because it's the most silly argument to make in terms of trying to further your case, in my opinion. And everybody has a right to their opinion. But whether recidivism is high or low, you can't violate the Constitution. You just can't. And I make my offer that I'll make this trade. I'll violate the Constitution on SORNA if you'll violate the Constitution on the Second Amendment, because we can save at least just one by having some sort of rational gun control. So if you'll throw out the Second Amendment, I'll throw out my people's rights. But until then, I'm not ready to do that.
Liberal mumbo jumbo you are spewing now.
Well, I mean, doesn't it make sense? If their argument is, if it'll save one, it's worth it. Okay, I'm in. If it saves one, okay, well, let's try to save one more. Why don't we stop the rapid fire of weapons so that we can still respect the constitutional right to possess a weapon in defense, but let's just slow down how quickly they can fire. And I bet that'll save at least one. Now, under your doctrine, if it saves one, it's worth it. So I'm with you. Let's try to save one more. And that's where that falls apart, because they'll immediately jump ship when you say, well, wait a minute, I thought you were willing to save one. It was worth it. So I prefer to tell them that it's not relevant. But now that the state has used that as a defense, we're prepared to demolish that as a defense. But it's not even relevant. But we still have to, in case the court is interested in going there, we're prepared to respond.
Interesting. Is there anything else that we got to cover on the Snyder in Indiana?
Well, unless Ashley has a counterpoint on that, on the recidivism, because I tend to try to stay away from recidivism unless I'm forced to talk about it.
Right, right.
So on the recidivism, I'm torn on it because I don't like the rates being thrown out there. But again, I think that we need to combat and refute any of the high recidivism rates because they're just flat out wrong. They're not backed up. But what I do like about this opinion is that we're not throwing those out there. The court is actually stating, look, this is what's going on. Here's a recidivism rate. So it almost takes the argument out of us having to make it and basically has a court stating, you guys are crazy. These are false rates. So that's what I like about the opinion.
Well, so, but what happens when there's like, you know, pitchforks and all that, families running around and tomatoing all of the registrants that then get some sort of relief and go to the school and participate, and everyone, you know, like there's a section cordon off for the parents, the sex offender parents.
Talking draconian.
I mean, but this is already draconian, and then the public's going to like lose their minds, and they will then find the most radical politician that is going to say, we must do these registry restriction things so that these people aren't anywhere near our kids so that they can harm them, regardless of what the recidivism rate is, knowing that it's 90% is somebody that you know, not some stranger. Stranger danger is a bullshit myth. So all that.
So we could go down a really bad path with that. My opinion on it is that you have the right to be fundamentally involved with your family. It goes right back to the litigation that's going on in Tennessee. How are you supposed to be a meaningful part of your family and be involved in your kids' lives and your wives, your husbands, everybody's lives? I see what you're saying, but I think that goes on to a whole other level of where we need to be doing more education in terms of this is not people running around taking opportunities to rape and pillage villages just because they get to go attend their kids' school event. But I think that's a whole global issue, and I totally see what you're saying, and I'm right. Not sure we can fix it right
now.
No, here.
And I agree with what you're saying, but is there an enumerated right, whatever, is there a constitutionally protected right that you get to be involved in your family?
Yes, there is.
Is that enumerated somewhere?
You have a fundamental right to get married, procreate, and be involved in your family. And I think there's actually an on-point Supreme Court decision that talks about that being one of the most fundamental rights. But the way that Supreme Court decision actually speaks about it is in terms of spousal privilege. And then it goes on to talk about I forget the actual term, but basically the sanctity of marriage and your family and it being a fundamental right. And I think that there's enough case law on that, that that argument could be made.
So
at least what it gets us to is having to have an individualized case by case basis that shows that you can't be around your family for some reason.
Right.
I don't think it's an automatic thing. And I think that's what they're using it as.
I think Larry has spoken to the level of individual tailoring of all of these things. Hey, if your crime involves something at a school, then perhaps it's wise to not have you at a school, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just say, oh, hey, you looked at some naughty pictures online. Now you can't be around the McDonald's playground. I mean, they're not related.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to combat. At the end of the day, I'm really glad that you brought that up because that's really what it comes down to. Maybe what we're not seeking is to do away with everything, but that it be individually tailored and not just these blanket conditions on everybody, regardless of what they did. You pee in public, all of a sudden you can't go to school. You go streaking at a baseball game, all of a sudden you can't be around your family. Yeah. So, no, I totally agree with that.
And to go back, excuse me, Larry, you talked a couple of weeks ago about the bill that you helped craft, I don't remember the details, but it was an internet restriction bill where, I mean, it was so individually tailored and targeted that like no one would be impacted by it. So instead of saying nobody in West Virginia at all under any circumstances can use the internet or Packingham in North Carolina, that these things get individually tailored and targeted down to the individual circumstances of the case and crime.
That is correct, and I'll talk about that just a second, and then I wanted to get back to the point Ashley made about the we don't want to knock down everything. I, in fact, do want to knock down everything.
Yeah.
But the problem is we can't knock down everything in the court. Things can be done constitutionally if they're narrowly tailored. So when you hear someone on our side who's in the legal business saying, well, we concede that you could do that under the right circumstances, that is not the same thing as us saying that we support that. That's us telling the court to maintain credibility as a legal professional to tell the court, if we say there's no set of circumstances by which you can register people, the judges would roll their eyes. They would turn their chairs around toward the front of the courtroom. They'd say, this case is concluded because you're a nut. Of course, there's registries that could be constitutional. So, but I would like to end as much as I can using the courts, and what I can't end with the courts because it's been narrowly tailored, I would like to try to end more through the legislative process because that's where public policy is actually made. But in terms of the internet restriction, we didn't actually propose an internet restriction. What we did was we responded to a bill that had been introduced that would have been an internet restriction bill, and we let the sponsor know that it wasn't likely to make it very far because it applied to all sexual offenders. And there was a case, in fact, out of Indiana about the same time, and this was 2011. And there was a case, federal case, out of Indiana. And we told him we, although it's not binding here, we believe that it will be, since it's a Seventh Circuit case, we believe it'll be very persuasive. And here's what you can do, because he said, well, we got to do something. And I said, well, what we can do is we can target the boogeyman that you're trying to target, which is the approaching of a minor for grooming purposes. And we can narrowly tailor some legislation that would say that the actual gravamen of the offense would be the reaching out to a minor on a social media platform. So we didn't eliminate anybody's right to be on a social media. We took the crime of electronic solicitation, which theoretically, if you're guilty of that, you have solicited either a minor or someone who purportedly was a minor. And we said people who've been convicted of that particular offense are not allowed to initiate, friend, or have contact with anyone on a social media platform, which we narrowly defined. It wasn't the bank and everything else. It was something like Facebook or MySpace, which is now defunct. but we said that if you reached out to a minor that wasn't related to you and attempting to engage that person in a friendship, that was prohibited conduct. But that didn't stop you from being on Facebook. It just said you could not knowingly have relations with an unrelated minor. Now, that was narrowly tailored that would have survived any judicial scrutiny. Do I support it? No, I don't. But if a lawmaker says, I've got mine, and this is what I'm going to push through unless you give me an alternative, I'm going to give them an alternative 100% of the time. And I'll take the heat for that 100% of the time, because I much prefer bills that I write over bills that they write. So anytime I get a chance, I'm going to, if I can't kill it, I'm going to put forth an alternative. That's just my philosophy. So people say, well, I shouldn't work with them. That's fine. That's your opinion. My opinion is I'd be writing the laws to them writing them. And if they're going to write something and it can't be killed, then you take your chances with what they write. Most of you aren't happy with what they write. So I think you'd rather take your chance with me.
Chime on in there, Ashley.
So just to clarify, Larry's made a very, very valid point in terms of, do I agree with any of this stuff? No, absolutely not. But I'm back to the individual. Let's try and get it individualized, because it's like what Larry said about the credibility. I've appeared in front of judges for, well, now it's at least been 25 years. I think it's closer to like 27. But I know that if you don't give them an out or give them a way, it's the same with legislators. If you don't give them a way to save face to their constituents, and you don't give the judges a way to stay elected, and you go in and you say, I want to abolish all of this, they're just going to laugh you out of the courtroom. They're going to laugh you out of the roundhouse up in the state capitol, no matter where you are. So if we go in and we start chipping away at it, and we keep chipping away at it, I actually think that's a better strategy. So I don't want anything that I say to be construed that, I think it's okay that you take people away from their families or anything. It's nothing like that. I just think there needs to be a good, strong strategy in order for us to minimize the damage.
Don't worry, Ashley. People misconstrue what we say all the time.
But I can't understand why it's so hard to misconstrue. If the registry is as bad as we say it is, and I do believe it is that bad, if there's 900,000 people in it, and we could make life better for 742,000 of them, wouldn't it be better for us to do that? Or should we let 900,000 suffer because we can't make everything better for 900,000? To me, that's such an asinine stance to say, well, just don't save anybody because you can't save everybody. I'm going to save as many as I can. That's until I'm not able to save anybody. I'm going to do as much as I can to save as many as I can.
You certainly have people that disagree with that idea.
Absolutely. I know I do. And they're entitled to disagree. They can try their position and see how far they get. And they can look at my position and they can see how far I've gotten, and they can figure out which one works better. So by all means, try your approach and see how well it works for you. Ashley, we're going to be doing some work in New Mexico. We've identified some priorities. Before we run out of time, Can we highlight some of the work that's going to be going on in our state just for the national audience? You're the first staff attorney for any state affiliate. Your job is going to start next week, assuming that the board doesn't reject the proposal when we have our meeting tomorrow. And what are you going to be working on for the Liberty and Justice Coalition?
I'm actually really excited about the things that we've outlined, and these will be in the newsletter. So a couple of things that we have on our agenda. Number one, we're looking at litigation to force New Mexico in particular to give due process under the Interstate Compact. When you have somebody that comes from out of state and I think we discussed it last week or the week before, but briefly, if you have somebody that comes from out of state and they're being supervised here, if they pick up a technical violation, not a new crime, they are not entitled to due process according to New Mexico. And what that means is you don't take them before a judge. You can hold a little kangaroo court hearing in a back room at the jail. They aren't entitled to counsel. There's a whole bunch of things. And they actually aren't even given adequate notice or anything so that they can defend themselves. And this is basically what they do in order to ship them back out. How many people does this affect? We know that there are 1,000 people here on the Interstate Compact, and we know that this is happening at least weekly, and they're sitting in jail for months, and nobody even knows they're there unless they have an attorney. So
that's one dear to my heart. So what else are you going to be doing in New Mexico?
We are also going to do litigation against the parole board for failure to release people convicted of sex offenses who have served their time just because they can't provide an adequate address. And we see this time and time again where they're exceeding the amount of time that they can give them. They're leaving them in prison until they can go out and find an acceptable address. And this could be everything that, it's too close to the church. It's too close to the sidewalk over there. It can be any reason. The house is dirty. I've actually even seen that. The house is dirty. So we're going to attack that as well. Another thing that we're going to do is a declaratory judgment seeking credit for time on registration dating back to enactment of retroactive registration requirements. And I believe on this one, Larry, aren't we looking at people that are coming from out of state that have been on a registry for a long time in another state? Or did you have something else in mind?
We are looking at those, and we're looking at an in-state component. We're looking at the people who were originally not required to register when registration became operational in 95. And then in 2000, they included people. Originally, you had to be convicted order after July 1, 95. And then they added a proviso for those who were in prison or on probation or parole. So people had been exiting the prison and probation and parole system during 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. And all of a sudden, they had a registration obligation they didn't have any knowledge about. And some of them weren't discovered for many years because they put together a fugitive squad to go out and find these people. But some of them were found a decade later, 12 years later. So our position is that if those people never left New Mexico and they were in the driver's license database or they were in the registered voters database or they're in some state database, you had a damn well had a duty to notify them, because the average person isn't going to check the legislative website each year and say, huh, I know I finished my probation in 96, but I wonder if they passed any retroactive law that would require me to have a new obligation. So these people went from 96 to 06, 08, 012, and all of a sudden they got one lady went down and applied to be a foster parent. And they read her background check. They said, oh, by the way, we can't approve you for this, but in addition, you need to get registered. Well, we think that for those 12 years that she didn't know that she had to register, she should get credit for that because she was here all along. So that's the basis for that. And for the people who were out of state who come in here, they've been registered for 17 years in another state complying. And then they're told, here, you got to start all over again under agency law. The Department of Public Safety says, well, we don't care about that. It says you have to register in New Mexico for 20 years or whatever the case may be.
No, and to me, this is a no-brainer. Like, I don't know why you wouldn't get credit for that, especially if you've been in the state for that period of time. Because if you're – so an equivalent thing to me is if you're in state's custody, the state should know that you're there. If you've been at the same address and they could have found you, they should have been able to find you. And so they're imputed with having to have that responsibility. So again, to me, this is a no-brainer, as well as the thing from the out-of-state for getting credit. I just don't see any scenario where you shouldn't get credit for time that you've served on the registry. There is not a compelling reason for me not to have that.
So, well, I think there's at least one other thing that we've got on the agenda, isn't there?
We actually have two more things on there. We have a declaratory judgment to strike down the blanket imposition of GPS monitoring as violated of due process without individualized determination of need for such monitoring. This goes right back to what we were talking about. Essentially, here they just throw GPSs on people, and what you've seen them on for a number of years on some people. Some people get it 8 months, some people get it. I think I saw somebody that had it on for 3 years without any sort of review, but without any scrutiny on why they were having the GPS monitoring. So, again, that's another no-brainer. And I think there's actually case law on that now, too.
There is. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case out of North Carolina, Grady. It does, in fact, constitute a search and seizure. So, therefore, there has to be more to it than just a blanket policy. And in the Massachusetts Supreme Court, citing Grady, they said that even though it was a state statute in Massachusetts, which it is a state statute in New Mexico for those under parole for a certain list of sex offenses, I think that we're just as vulnerable for that here, because you just can't search and seize people. A seizure and search has to be reasonable. You know, that's what the Constitution says. Which amendment is that? I think you have to justify search and seizure. There has to be
force.
Yeah. It's nice that the state passed the statute, but it's unconstitutional, but they can do it until they're stopped. And we're going to try to stop them. You guys on the law enforcement side, we are coming for you.
That's right.
And what else are we coming for them on?
We are coming, and I was wrong. We have two more other things. We have an ambitious agenda, and I'm really, like I said, I'm really excited about this because I think all these are really, really important. And I think that we have the mechanisms to start challenging this stuff. The next one is similar to the Interstate Compact, except it's different in terms of forcing the parole board to provide due process on parole revocation hearings under the indeterminate 5-year to 20-year parole statute. And essentially what we just recently saw them do this, that we think they did this, where they called somebody in without due process, didn't give them an attorney, wouldn't allow anybody at the hearing, and then gave them an additional 16 years under that. So that's what we're looking to fight on that, because it's no longer just a parole. it's no longer just a release. You're actually increasing the sentence again.
And that's going to be guided by Haymond, which is a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, which New Mexico apparently doesn't know about it, doesn't think it applies to them.
Yes, we need to educate them on the Supreme Court cases do actually apply. So,
And what was the last one?
The last one is litigation to strike various unconstitutional provisions of the New Mexico Behavioral Contract for Sex Offenders on Probation. And essentially, the things that we're looking at targeting, and this is not an inclusive list, are some of the employment requirements, as well as there's a vague clause in there about not being able to attend anywhere that children are at. And we've seen this across probation officers, be anywhere from a casino to a Walmart to McDonald's to restaurants to malls. And there isn't any specificity. I'm totally screwing up that word. Some of the other things are a ban on social media and some of the other travel restrictions, back to the not allowing them to travel between counties, even if you're on the lowest level of supervision. So I think we have our work cut out for us.
We definitely have an ambitious agenda, and we're going to need financial support. Our model is going to be that we're going to try to go into federal court as often as we can for as many of these causes as we can, and hopefully prevail and collect attorney's fees. But this model will only work if our people support us, and we're going to need to continue. This is going to be a very long-term battle. This is not going to be something we're going to finish. In fact, the entire cause is going to be perpetual.
Wait a minute. You got to stop right there for a second. Ashley, you're not working for free? You're not doing pro bono?
I am to a certain extent, but I have to eat, Andy. For some unknown reason, I require food.
How dare you? I'm sorry.
I know.
Okay. I just wanted to check because, you know, there's a whole lot of contention about, you know, lawyers doing the work for free because I had this massive injustice. So you should.
Well,
I know.
Those people should read my column in the newsletter this month because we did a study about pro bono services, and I wrote a column about pro bono. So read the August issue of the Digest where we talk about what kind of success we had getting pro bono services in our study.
Yeah.
Ashley, we're coming up on an hour. We've enjoyed it. It's flown by.
It has flown by. And I really appreciate you having me on this, as always. And again, feel free to, if anybody has any questions or anything that comes up as a result of this. And I think we also probably want to point out that we are looking for plaintiffs, if anybody knows of people that fit into some of the criteria that we're looking at in New Mexico. We are trying to identify plaintiffs, aren't we, Larry?
We are. And the number one case we're trying to get launched, and we wish it was already launched, was the people who have been convicted in other states and have moved here. There's about 560 that are awaiting translation. And those people have not been provided due process pursuant to State versus Hall. And since they're not going to start providing due process until they're forced to, we're going to see if we can convince them to provide due process and make sure that they have a fair process that determines whether or not they have an obligation to register. And if they do, under what component of our law, would they be a 10-year, would they be a 20-year, would they be a lifetime? And that's not going to be someone up there at the Santa Fe office with a form checking off boxes. That's not due process.
No.
So that one's the one where we're definitely looking for plaintiffs. If you've been convicted in another state and you're registering New Mexico, we'd like to hear from you. And it's not because the argument is not that you shouldn't have to register at all. We're not, this cause of action is not challenging the Constitution or the registry. It's challenging the lack of due process since State versus Hall was handed down. The Supreme Court of our state said that there has to be an individualized determination if that offense is equivalent, and if so, to which one. Since they haven't done that for you, it may be that they have you properly. But since you didn't get a process, you didn't get any input to give your version of whether that offense should be properly as they've decided. They may have put you as a lifetime. You may not have had a lifetime. You may have had a 10-year obligation. Or they may have told you that you had to register and your offense doesn't translate. That's the whole basis that Hall won his case on. Hall didn't have a registration obligation because he had a California conviction that's not equivalent to anything in the state, but yet they were telling him administratively that it was equivalent, and he fought it. He said, the hell with you people, and he fought it. And we've discovered in our research about 40 people have that same conviction that he had that same statute section from California, about 40 people in the state have that same conviction, and they're still registering.
No, I think that these are really important battles, and I think that there's a theme in these, if at least in most of them, about due process. And I think it's really important that we focus on the fact that you're entitled to due process for a lot of things that people just aren't getting them on. And this is definitely one of them.
Well, the life, you can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. Registration deprives you of liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes property.
And life.
Mm-hmm. And
so,
life.
So, yep. So therefore, there's a due process that's going to have to be afforded people. And if you don't like what it costs you, boys and girls, then don't have the damn scheme to start with. It's like the Interstate Compact. Yes, it's going to cost the state some money to have these probable cause hearings where attorneys are participating and judges are overseeing them. But you're absolutely right. It's going to cost money. Well, if you don't want it to cost any money, then opt out of the Interstate Compact and say we can't afford it. And our offenders won't go to any other state, and no state offenders will come here. But if you're in this process and you've opted in, you've got to provide it. Unfortunately, it costs money. And I know the people that hate paying taxes or hate to hear me say that, but things we've agreed to do, they do have costs attached to them.
Yes, they do. Right, so, back to that free thing. Right, Andy?
Yes, 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 yes.
So,
well, thank you so much, Ashley, for joining us. It was awesome to have you, and I hope we'll have you back soon.
I hope so, too, and thank you again, and you guys have a great night.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
You know, we should probably, let's cover the Scalia clip. Are you ready for that?
I am ready. This is kind of a little bit longer than what we typically
it is
have.
It's certainly
about
long.
Three minutes.
So I'm going to pause for just a couple seconds. Go get your popcorn, go get your beer, and we're going to cover Scalia. And this also, it's a long clip.
Yes. No one wants to miss Scalia.
I expect, or rather I fear, that the court's use of foreign law in the interpretation of the Constitution will continue at an accelerating pace. And I think so for three reasons. First, because the living Constitution paradigm for the task of constitutional interpretation prevails on the court, and indeed in the legal community generally. Under this living Constitution view, it is the task of the court to make sure that the current Constitution comports with, as we have put the point in the Eighth Amendment context, quote, the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society, close quote. Thus, a constitutional right to abortion, which assuredly did not exist during the first few centuries of our country's existence, does exist today. Likewise, a constitutional right to homosexual conduct. Of course, I disagree with this living constitution approach, but that is not my purpose here to debate originalism. Rather, my point is that once you assume the power to revise what the Constitution requires in order to keep it up to date, once you assume that power, then the criticism voiced by the court in Prince, which I quoted earlier, namely that comparative analysis is inappropriate to the task of interpreting a constitution, though it was, of course, quite relevant to the task of writing one, that criticism no longer has any bite. You are engaged in the process of writing a constitution, and there is no reason whatever not to consult foreign materials in doing it. I suppose it could be argued that you can be a living constitutionalist who wants to create only a new American constitution, you know, a sort of a a living constitutionalist who doesn't care what foreign countries think, but wants to update the American Constitution according to the likes of Americans. Well, that's certainly a possible position. It is not, however, one that I think is likely to prevail, because I do not think very many living constitutionalists are likely to be what you might call chauvinistic living constitutionalists. That is, dedicated to effecting only those changes in the Constitution that the American people desire. The American people can make their will well enough known by creating new rights legislatively through the federal and state legislatures, or in the last analysis by amending the Constitution in the democratic method that the Constitution contains. One who believes that it falls to the courts to update the list of rights guaranteed by the Constitution tends to be one who believes in a platonic right and wrong in these matters, which wise judges are able to discern when the people at large cannot.
You have some sort of ulterior motive for putting us through that 3 minutes.
Was it 3 minutes?
3:30, actually.
Wow. Well, I'm talking to our listeners who I periodically get, well, Larry, don't you understand this stuff violates international law? And I said, well, but wait a minute, international law has no place in American courtrooms, according to many of our justices and some of the most admired justices. But conveniently, international law is supposed to apply. And those who believe in the evolving standards of decency, providing them new rights, that is not the view held by a significant number of the court currently that are sitting there, including the late Justice Scalia. So I'd like for people to realize that the type of court we have right now does not believe, and I partially share that view, it's not their role, just because they have the privilege of wearing a black robe, to decide what is best for us and what we should and should not do and what is good and bad public policy. That is for us to do, which Scalia articulately says. You can create new rights. You can jettison bad policy through the democratic process. Merely wearing a robe does not entitle them to come in and substitute their judgment and say, well, I think I'd prefer if it was done this way, or if that wasn't done. The only thing they're entitled to do, if you believe in the limited role of judiciary, their role is very limited, is to stop the encroachments when it's clearly proven that something's being done cannot be done constitutionally, not because it's not good public policy or it's bad public policy or there's a better way to do it. That's not a part of the legal analysis that the court gets to make. There may be a better way to keep the air clean, but that's not for the court to decide. If we decide that we want to restrict carbon dioxide or monoxide or whatever the crazy gas is that's harmful to people, and we make it so horribly expensive that power plants can't operate, that's not a constitutional issue. That's a public policy issue. If the power bills go high enough and electricity becomes scarce enough, you'll change your public policy. But that's not for the court to say, well, we think you can get clean air by this approach. So that's kind of the point. Every time when we put a Scalia clip in here, we're wanting people to think about the role of the court. And hopefully it will inspire you to quit waiting on the court to save you. And it'll inspire you to start working through the beautiful process that we have to save ourselves. So that's my motivation.
You said the judiciary has limited roles, but all three branches individually have their limited roles of what they're supposed to do. You don't have the legislative branch running in and putting on black robes and adjudicating people.
That is correct. They're carefully tried to balance the roles of each branch of government. And there's always attempts by the executive branch feels that they're hamstrung because they have to deal with the legislative branch and then they have to worry about the courts. And there's always this jockeying for power. And the courts are the ultimate decider of when there's too much power being usurped. Ultimately, they decide that. But they tend to defer on issues where they don't have to get involved. That's their role, is not to be a super referee for what bad decisions we make.
Right.
And that's what a lot of our people seem to want. They say, well, they put that law in the books, and clearly that's not the best way to do that. But that's not their role to decide what was the best way to do that.
And that would be for us to be involved with our legislature to bring them facts, stats, and all of the things to present ourselves as experts to them so that they could rely on us for what is the best way to get there, like you did with that example of the internet social media thing. That would be, quote unquote, best practice.
It would be best practice, but that requires the vestiture of time, and it requires commitment to learning. And I know that when I dredge up the name William Bennett, there's only going to be one person listening here that knows who he was. But well, there's at least one more listening that knows. I know David knows exactly who Bill Bennett. He was a first Secretary of Education, I think, in the Reagan administration. But Bennett said that it wasn't the federal government's responsibility to provide a college education for everyone. Now, that's a debatable public policy. Maybe it is, but Dr. Bennett thought it wasn't. And he said that in order to go to college, that you may have to divest yourself of some of the entertainment and a stereo and different things so that you go to college. Well, if you want to be effective in public policy, you may have to divest yourself of going to Hooters or going to a concert, or you may have to reprioritize your life so that you put more time into civic responsibility. It may require some sacrifice. I can't make it any easier, for the process does require just a tad bit of work.
I do have to take exception to you saying Hooters, because that's one of the worst restaurants ever.
Well, it's worst in some people's opinion. I think there'll be people out there that would disagree with you.
But so talking about the college argument, and I don't want to get too far down this, but then why would you say that public, primary school is provided for everybody? The parents should pick themselves up so mom can stay home or dad can stay home and educate the kids.
Well, I'm not going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Dr. Bennett's philosophy was that it was not the federal government's responsibility to to pay for a college education. And he thought that the government was doing enough with Pell Grants and the aid packages that it had in those days. And he said that if you want to go to college, it may require divestiture.
Yeah.
He said, you know, your spring break when you go to Florida and to Mexico and to Acapulco and these different places you go, you may have to divest of those things. And I'm just making the analogy that in order to be effective in public policy advocacy, you may have to divest of some enjoyable things and trade that time for something that you don't enjoy quite as much to be effective.
I think that we should worry about Illinois putting ankle monitors on thousands of people, and it has to figure out who is going to get tracked and then why. And it turns out that there really aren't any sort of rhyme or reason behind it. This article comes from the Marshall Project. And as with all things from the Marshall Project, they're long. And this one, your position on ankle monitor things is so that it would be a diversion from going inside the walls, but it is used in addition to, hey, now we can supervise more people. And this, they're supposed to, sex offenders and other violent crimes are just supposed to be on ankle monitors. Not just supposed to, they are required by law. Not all of them are on monitors. And then on the flip side of that, there are people with other kinds of nonviolent offenses, and some of them are on ankle monitors. And it doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason behind why Illinois is doing this.
Well, I know we've got a faithful listener in New Mexico that can explain all that, and that's because I think she calls it the ankle monitoring GPS industrial complex. But my opposition is that what has happened, and it was logically foreseeable for anybody who cared to look, when you have a new technology evolves faster than laws and policies can evolve. So what you have is a play toy coming into the scene that you didn't have. Oh, this neat little thing, it'll track all these people. Well, gee, it would be great to have all this information on people. Well, the problem is that a lot of people were gathering information on we don't really have a right to know. We don't, when you're charged with a crime, ankle monitoring has become so popular in pretrial release that I would say that more people are subjected to it than not when they're on warrant conditions of release. Now, I don't have any facts to back that up. I'm just taking a wild stab at what I see in terms of conditions of release. But if somebody, particularly I know in the federal system, if you actually don't get held in detention, you're going to be on GPS monitoring at the very minimum. So we have all these people that are presumed innocent who are having an extreme invasion on them during the time that they're presumed innocent, rather than what would be a beautiful use of this technology would be to use it for people who you're tailoring a specific program for them. We would have you in prison, but we've got this new technology and we think that you can be safely monitored in the community because we can keep track of you. So we're going to try to release you from prison early to save our costs. We can cut our costs by 2/3 by having you out of the community. That's a beautiful use of ankle monitoring because you've actually given the opportunity for the person to earn money. You've given the opportunity to cut the state's cost for incarceration, and you've reintegrated the person into society, assuming they take advantage of that. A person who might be tempted to not be respectful of geographic boundaries that are legitimately imposed, not just because we have a blanket geographic boundary, but you can't be within 2,000 feet of this victim's home under any circumstances. Well, all the evidence shows that that person has been engaged in a pattern of trying to have contact with that person. That would be an appropriate use of GPS because I don't want to have to put you in custody. But what I am going to tell you is that since I believe that you can't suppress your own temptations, we're going to help suppress them by electronically monitoring you. Or if a person who violates curfew, well, is the best course of action to put them back behind the walls? No. It's, Andy, you seem to have a problem. I came by your house at 11:45 last night and your curfew was 9 and I gave you a warning. And then I came back 2 weeks later at 1 a.m. and your car was gone. So it looks like that I've got one or two choices. I can seek to revoke your supervision, or would you agree to be monitored by this? I know it's not going to feel good on your leg, but wouldn't you prefer this over the alternative? Because I'll leave the choice up to you.
You know, I got to tell you, you've given me a bunch of dialogues like this before. And right off, like, there is no way that anyone in those uniforms is coming like, don't you think it would be better if we did? No, they would just be like, hey, put this thing on your leg and shut your pie hole and we're moving on. Oh, and so they're
but,
not.
But I'm articulating what would be a proper use of the technology. I'm for the evolvement of technology and utilization of technology. But we have to define, see, the technology evolves faster than the standards of which we use it. So I'm saying that when these technologies come online, there has not been enough thought. A part-time legislature that meets 30 days in a year is not going to have time. All they're going to have is the people they trust come in with these beautiful uniforms telling them how great this is and how they can keep the public safer. And you need to give us $3.5 million in our budget so we can monitor our offender caseload. And they're going to say, yes, sir. And they're going to check off on the box and give the appropriation. And not enough thought goes into how to deploy this technology, which I support, but it gets misused. And it could serve beautiful purposes if it were used correctly. But technology is because they're not used in a tailored fashion. They're not used to where they can be the most beneficial for society. They're used because I've got a $3.5 million budget. And if I don't use all these GPS devices, I'm not going to get the same budget for next year. That's actually what happens. You spend it or lose it.
Right, yeah. And then from the Chicago Tribune, Illinois eliminates statute of limitations on major sex crimes. So it's over, like 75 years later, someone can say he made me feel uncomfortable and now you get prosecuted?
That's what it appears to be. That Good one just grief. Popped up. But I've been telling people for some time now that this is a trend that's not going to stop. The victims' advocates, the victims' industrial complex is going to continue till there's no statute of limitations. And it wouldn't be so bad if they weren't also eroding the due process and the standard and burden of proof. If they weren't making it by statute that the defense can't assert anything in their defense, they can't confront anyone in their defense, and that we presume everything that's being alleged 40 years later is true. If we could actually have a robust confrontation where that they could actually grill the victim and say, now you really don't remember this 40 years ago, do you? But we're not allowed to say that because that's re-victimizing the victim. So if we actually weren't jettisoned the due process, it wouldn't be so bad, because if the prosecution was held to its proper standard of proof, most prosecutors would tell you well, you know, yes, I've got the authority to bring a 30-year-old case, but I'm not going to because I can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So I'm not going to try to indict a case like that. But once you erode the fact they don't have to prove anything, just the mere accusation is enough to convict. Of course, well, if all I've got to do is make the accusation and we hamstring the defense where they can't put up any kind of defense, well, of course, you're going to have more of these. And what it's going to take is going to be that people are going to be convicted like a Judge Moore. In Alabama. Now, this is not Alabama, this is Illinois, but it's going to take people like that being convicted. And people are going to say, wow, how's that happening? I thought in America, you're supposed to be presumed innocent. How are all these people being convicted with no evidence? And then we're going to have to go back and revisit some of the crazy changes that we've made and rebuild our due process.
Right. And, you know, I moved an article around on you just for this because, you know, an article popped up, Al Franken ended up in the news, and I really, like, this would not be outside of the statute of limitations, but he was accused of by multiple people of doing things, not even, I don't want to say that bad, but it wasn't like he was raping, but he was doing uncomfortable things, literally from that context, and forced out. And there was never an investigation. And the article, another long read, but a bunch of his former colleagues were saying, yeah, I probably overreacted and you know, suggested that he leave office, resign, just based on these allegations.
His was, as I recall, it's been some time now, but his was more of a sexual harassment.
Yes, 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 yes.
Making inappropriate comments and beyond well, there, that, I don't remember all the specifics.
There was a picture of I want to say she's a conservative talk show radio personality, and they were doing a USO tour. And the big thing that I remember was like they were on some military flight moving from A to B, and she kind of looked like, you know, she was asleep. She was wearing a flak vest. She was wearing a bulletproof vest, and she had a Kevlar helmet on. And Al Franken, like in the picture, he's posed up to her, not touching her, but with his hands grabbing her midsection there, you know, on her boobs. But he wasn't touching her. But yeah, this would be humiliating, offensive, and so forth. And those things spiraled out. And, you know, supposedly he did some kissing things. Okay. So yeah, like you said, sexual harassment. I don't want to diminish that she feels uncomfortable and all this stuff, but you, like, anyway, these guys are people in the Senate are retracting their, yeah, we probably maybe made a mistake there by kicking him or suggesting that he resign.
So, well, there's another rabbit hole I don't want to go down necessarily, but I tend to believe that there should be due process provided and real due process provided. That's what we talked about earlier. And I believe that the seriousness of the accusation does not automatically translate to guilt. If that were the standard, simply just you just make serious allegations against anybody you didn't like and say, well, these are very serious allegations. So it's a serious allegation, and the presumption goes with the person until you prove that allegation beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's not their job to prove anything.
Right. Right.
And somehow or another, we get intimidated to tell people that. Yes, you made the accusation. Yes, you have to prove it. And then they come forward and say, well, it was 22 years ago and I was intimidated. Unfortunately, bad things happen in society. There's power mismatches. There's people have we can't have a perfect society.
Sure.
Unfortunately, you missed your time opportunity. Yeah, we're sorry.
I do.
We can't do anything for you.
I have a shocking announcement for you. The articles from the Huffington Post that sex offender registries don't keep kids safe, but politicians keep expanding them anyway. I was having a conversation with one of our listeners the other day about whatever. So politician voted for thing, something got signed into law. And forgive me, I was essentially channeling my inner Larry and I was regurgitating things that you have said, at least to what I understand them to be, in that they can't not vote for them, that they would then be thrown out of office the next go around. You have to get in there and figure out a way to derail it before anybody is held accountable publicly for saying no to any of these sex offender things that are they, because I think it was the Tennessee thing was then enacted because a bunch of people from Alabama moved to Tennessee because Tennessee is quote unquote better than Alabama, which anything would be better than Alabama. But I was like, they have to vote for it because you can't turn your state into like the U-Haul capital and have everyone moving there. But you would have to stop it in some sort of committee or something of that sort before they have to vote.
As a general rule, anything that makes it to the floor is going to be approved. And when I say the floor, I mean the floor of whatever chamber bill it is. It could be a House bill, it could be a Senate bill. But if it gets to the floor, it's not going to be turned down. It's even tough in committee because committee votes are recorded as well. But you can insulate more people in committee. If you've got a 70-member House and you've got a 15-member Judiciary Committee, well, would you rather expose 70 or 15?
Yeah.
So in a Judiciary Committee, you can figure out how to expose people that probably can withstand the attack, because they will be attacked. If you vote for anything, a vote against anything, or vote for anything that helps the sex offender, or votes against anything that it's not going to crack down on sex offenders, you're going to likely be vilified at some point in the future.
I can speak to that here in the state when Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams were running. She voted against something that was going to enhance sex offender obligations of some sort. I don't remember the details of it, but I happened to be seeing a commercial from his side of things, and it was like, Stacey Abrams wants sex offenders living right next door to you. And it's like, hang on, hold up. When you actually go look at it, it was not improving anybody's safety. So she voted for it because it was, quote unquote, bad policy. But he turns around and turns it into a political campaign talking point for him to go beat the crap out of her.
Well, this will stop working when the people stop supporting folks who react that way. So it means our attitude has to change. You don't hear public vilification of homosexuals anymore. Do you know why? Because it doesn't sell politically.
Yep.
It doesn't broadly sell. Now, there are places where it's still quite popular.
There are still some places that'll do that.
Yeah, but on a large scale, that's not, and you pay a horrendous economic price because there's going to be a boycott.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that your state governor, the previous governor, vetoed the bathroom bill because they were fearful of the economic consequences.
Right. That was right on the heels of the NCAA tournament. Right. For the basketball tournament. They were like, nope, we're not coming there.
Yeah. And that governor, conservative Republican, but he responded to business. Business said, we can't stand the loss of business that we're going to have as a result of this.
Yeah.
And he vetoed the toilet bill.
Yep.
But that was because of public opinion. I can't tell you for certainty because I don't have a direct pipeline to the former governor, but I could just about bet that he didn't have a personal problem with you having to use the toilet of your designated birth certificate gender. But he did have a great deal of sympathy for the business interest who said this is going to kill us.
Yeah.
And so when it stops working, it will be when the people no longer support that position. Now, when is that going to happen? I can't tell you.
Yeah.
When are people going to come around that this whole thing is a hoax? It doesn't do anything. It's violating the Constitution, and it should embarrass them as Americans to have their name attached to anything. Like the quote in the Arkansas article about the Halloween, one of the law enforcement officials says, "We know who these people are, and now we're going to have the tools to keep control of them." Well, I guarantee you that his constituents are calling him up and saying, "Attaboy, that's why we elected you, Sheriff."
Yeah.
When his constituents call him up and say, "Really? You actually don't think people should be able to? I mean, Halloween is a great time for kids, and you actually feel strongly that." But he didn't get a single phone call like that. He did not receive a single phone call. All the phone calls he received was attaboy.
Mm-mm. Yeah, just like the sheriffs here in Georgia on the Halloween bill, they're like, "Thanks for keeping us safe, Sheriff." Seriously. I mean, I glanced over at the Facebook site and saw that he was getting all those kind of comments.
Well, see, this is where I tie back to Scalia. Scalia says you fix bad public policy by changing the public's mind.
Yes.
Okay, well.
That's hard to do, though. God, is that hard to do. We have 330 million Americans, and there's a significant portion of us that are low-information voters. Low-information. You know, we collect information from highly unreliable sources. It seems ridiculous.
No.
I know. It seems ridiculously hard to overcome that challenge. All right. Well, then the appeal, this one is very interesting to me because I've heard some podcasts on this particular, the Flowers versus Mississippi. It's the power of peremptory strikes. And I don't want to get into a whole lot, but unless you want to, but there's something in here that really touches me, is that a prosecutor should bring a case that he thinks would have broad enough support that he should be able to put anybody on the bench, doesn't matter, and they would vote. You know, he would be able to provide a compelling enough case. He shouldn't have to strike anybody. But the defense side, they should be able to have these kinds of strikes. And I like the idea. but I'm sure there's something wrong with the way that I'm thinking about it. Do you want to go over what the Flowers versus Mississippi thing is real quick?
Well, it was about a prosecutor in Mississippi who kept racially sanitizing a jury, so he didn't have any black Afro-Americans for a black defendant. And he used what's called a peremptory challenge, which is a challenge that doesn't need to be supported by cause to strike. And each jurisdiction allows a different number of peremptory challenges. And generally, the more serious the offense, the more peremptory challenges you're given, because it saves judicial economy. If you have to go into developing cause, that means you have to get into an inquisition with the juror to try to show the cause and get the court to agree with you. If you've just read their preliminary questionnaire and the stuff that you provided, you got enough background information and you know that they're not going to be a suitable juror, you can just say, Judge, we're using a peremptory strike here. Well, this is a position that the DA should not be allowed to have peremptory, because they're currently, each side has an equal number of peremptory challenges. But under Batson versus Kentucky, and I believe that Flowers case, the Supreme Court has reiterated that the state cannot use theirs for racially driven purposes to sanitize a jury. I don't know if I've formulated an opinion about whether you should take the DA. I've never been on the prosecution side.
Okay.
So I would have to know what their justification is for having peremptory challenges before I can say that I want to take those away from them. Out of fundamental fairness, it seems like that they should have some challenges that they don't have to state a cause for, but I don't know.
Right. And just for the quick background, and don't take me with a whole lot of confidence, the case is a black guy in 86 in a, he gets accused of murder, and they bring him to trial 6 times, and 3 or 4 of them were overturned, and then the prosecutor goes right back in and goes for another bite at the apple 6 times. So then he finally gets it to go to the Supreme Court, and as far as I know, they overturned it, and he should be freed, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'm not clear, because they're not going to want to free him. The state can't let go of a convicted murderer, so they may, unless the Supreme Court, and I didn't read that one thoroughly enough to know if they squelched any future prosecution potential in that decision. But unless they did, unless the Supreme Court prohibited any further proceedings and said it's dismissed with prejudice, which is how they would do that.
Yes.
That if they overturned it with instructions for it to be dismissed with prejudice, the state will go another time. They're not going to give up on letting convicted murderer
Good
out. They're
grief.
Just not going to do that.
But I mean, yeah, like, but there's like really sketchy evidence, like wrong eyewitness kind of things. And
well, I remember the witness said, well, got it wrong, but who cares about that? They thought I had it right at the time. So, I mean, enough time's gone by. So
that sounds like the statute of limitations stuff we just talked about a few minutes ago. Doesn't matter.
We can't be bothered with you people are all about technicalities.
I know, God, and having actual evidence to support a claim behind a charge accusing someone of doing something. Another one from the appeal is a spotlight. It's called Spotlight. Scalia called Stevens, who just recently passed away, evolution arrogance. And this is an analysis of saying that Stevens had evolved his position on many subjects. He's the justice that was appointed by a Republican president, and then either the court moved further right or his positions moved left, one or the other. Is that right?
Well, that is correct. He was appointed by unelected president Gerald Ford, unelected vice president Gerald Ford, the only person who ascended through that route. But he was appointed under what the McConnell Doctrine would have been. He would not have been allowed because it would belong to the next president
for decades.
But
we just won't set anybody for decades.
He was confirmed handily, and he was replacing the liberal Justice William O. Douglas, and there was a great deal of trepidation about his appointment. He turned out to be a fabulous justice, and he claims he retired at 90 and he passed away at 99, and he wrote and he said that he didn't change his position. He said the court changed. So since he was there, I'll take him at his word that his positions didn't change. I think that positions do change. I think as you learn more in life, you evolve. I think anybody who claims that they don't evolve, they're very close-minded, because my positions have evolved. And they continue to evolve as I learn more about stuff I don't understand or didn't understand as well. I said, gee, now that I have that information I didn't have, I was actually wrong about that. I used to not be a supporter of affirmative action. I figured out that I was wrong about affirmative action. I didn't understand why we have it. I used to be an opponent against hate crimes. I said, well, gee, it's already against the law. But I did not realize that people go out in the ordinary course of doing business as a criminal, you may be committing crimes because you need to support a drug habit. But people who are driven to commit hate crimes, it's not in the ordinary course of doing business for a drug crime necessarily to support their drug habit. It's because they don't like a particular ethnic or sexuality or something. So they don't have any economic need, not that that justifies committing the crime, but they're driven by hatred.
Yes.
And that elevates it above and beyond just a person who grabs the old lady and she fights back and they punch her in the face and take her purse. That doesn't justify punching the old lady and taking her purse. But that was driven by the desire to have the contents of the purse, not by hatred. My point is, I think the justice did evolve. I think we all evolve. If we don't evolve, there's something wrong with us. Because we learn more as we go through life and we have more life experience to look back on. And we say, gee, I have information I didn't used to consider. So, of course, I've evolved.
I have an observation. I have scoured this article looking for either Ford or O'Douglas, and I didn't find it. So that means you just have that on the tip of your head as a recallable fact?
Yes. Well, doesn't everyone?
No, everyone does not.
So, well, I can't imagine not a soul that I associate with wouldn't know that.
You must associate with people in like a Civil War cemetery.
I can assure you that everyone that's listening to this podcast remembers the appointment of every Supreme Court justice, the confirmation process. They remember we talked about Bork and we talked about Ginsburg, the one that didn't get confirmed in Ginsburg. And I bet there's people listening to this podcast that remember the Haynesworth and Carswell back in the Nixon administration. Of course, everybody knows that.
Yes, of course. And then before everyone just like rolls their eyes and laughs at us, I shouldn't even say that this is my favorite, but this next one is from the Huffington Post. Feds released sickening video of a cop tasering innocent teen, leaving him brain damaged. I love this, Larry. I love this just because I just think that our society, like, we should be able to stop this, but we can't. Here's a kid. Go ahead.
Well, we'll never be able to stop this because we have this attitude that's pervasive that we do not deserve, nor are we qualified to oversee our police or to affect the policies by which we're policed. We believe that the police should be able to determine which weapons they use, what equipment they use, how they deploy it, how much manpower, who they stop, how they interrogate. And until we change our attitude to we take control of our police departments, we're going to continue to have this sickening behavior because we have deferred our responsibility to oversee our police, and we've decided that they know best and that we're not capable of overseeing our police department. So that's the problem.
So here's a cop that pulls over a kid that's going, this is 2014, and the kid was 17. He was going over to his friend's house to play some video games, and the cop pulls him over because he believes that the license plate is something of a car that may be inappropriated, and so it's a stolen, they think it's a stolen car. Turns out that that's complete bullshit. Cop pulls him over. The kid's resistant to some degree. So the cop decides, hey, I'm going to taser the kid because I will teach this little shit a lesson. And he tases him for 20 seconds, which by reading it, it says that that is the equivalent of 4 actual, like, I guess, squeezes of the trigger or something like that, however these things work. So now the kid's like limp. He drags him out of the car, throws him on the ground, puts him in handcuffs, then drags him off to the side and drops him. Obviously, the kid can't like break his fall. So then his head smashes in the concrete. And now he has brain damage. The cop gets 4 years, which I'm not really in favor of more punishment, but this 4 years doesn't quite sound like enough for this to be almost like an intentional violent act to me.
Well, I would say that I don't like the second guess penalties because the process is there and the officer has the right to put on mitigation. And his exemplary life and all the things that he's done, and he should not be judged by that one event. But I'm looking at it more as a systemic side of it.
Yes.
Is that if we controlled our police departments, see, what he was the victim of was a pretextual stop. And if you've never been the victim of a pretextual stop, then you don't know how it feels. And the average Anglo-Saxon American seldom gets a pretextual stop. But minorities experience them routinely because they're on a fishing expedition and they do a pretextual stop. And they're not going to say, I pulled you over because you're black or pulled you over because you're Hispanic. They're going to say, you resemble someone who's on our wanted list, or this car came up as whatever. And that's a pretextual stop so that they can justify them when they get you pulled over. Then they start asking you a bunch of questions that you find very demeaning because you've done nothing wrong. And you find it in America as a U.S. born citizen. You don't understand why that driving down the street, breaking no laws, and they're telling you that your car is wanted. And you know good and well the car is not wanted because your parents own it and it's paid for or whatever. You find that to be very invasive. So the person who's never experienced that, they would say, well, he should have just cooperated with a cop. Well, the person who lives with that as a regular course of their life, they are not wired to just continue to submit to what they consider to be a blatant unconstitutional action.
I have one. So this kid is a white kid, though.
Yeah, well, and it may have been that he was in the wrong part of town. I didn't read the ethnicity, but he may have gotten pulled over because he had his windows tinted.
Right.
He may have been pulled over because he was making too much noise with the boom boom boom. I don't know what was the potential reason for, but whatever the reason was, it's often a pretextual stop for some other motivation because he's young, he's got a fancy car, he's got to be running dope. If I can just get him pulled over, I'll find out he's running dope. And if you, at some point, you get tired of that.
Yeah.
Whether it's because you're young, or whether it's because you're a minority, it's not just minorities who get pretextual stops. I don't mean to imply that. Absolutely not. The people get pretextual stops for a number. I'm told, I have not experienced this because I don't have an RV, but I'm told that people driving recreational vehicles that are male will get pulled over almost 100% of the time in certain states. Because that's the profile of a drug runner. I don't have an RV. I don't know that, but I guarantee you if I did have an RV and I've never smoked a joint in my life, at some point I would get tired of being pulled over so they could do their protectional run. And I'm told that they'll let their dogs go through and say, well, if you don't have anything to, you know, just let the dogs go through real quick and then be on your way. At some point I'd get tired of the dogs scratching up my RV, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. No doubt.
So
I'm just really bothered by this because I'm like the stop is one thing, the tasing seems ridiculously excessive, and then also the brain damage. Now you've impaired this child's ability. He's now 21, I guess, or 22. He says, yeah, I forget that I have job interviews. Like I just wake up and I go, nothing going on today, and I miss job interviews. And presumably that's a result of this interaction with the police. And it shouldn't be this way.
If we regulated the use of force by our police rather than saying it's all officer discretion, we probably would have a lot fewer of these conversations. Now, I know that's micromanaging, but that's what we have to do.
Right.
Because clearly they cannot contain themselves. And clearly we have to give them more guidance in terms of what they can do. And we just don't let them make their own procedures and deploy what can be. These tasers can be lethal.
Absolutely. Totally. They're sending hundreds of thousands of watts through your body. That's low amperage, but they're sending hundreds of thousands. And if it hits you in the right place and you are possibly, you know, predisposed to be sensitive to it, yeah, it will totally kill you.
So yes, I'm a believer that we have a responsibility to oversee our police departments. I'm sorry, police, not meaning to there's a lot of fine officers
absolutely
out there doing some great work, but it's just like with criminals. We make rules for those who are renegade, for those who are rogue. I think cops should admit that about 95% of all Americans are good law-abiding citizens. Well, you make the laws for the 5% that are rogue. Well, the same thing with police misconduct.
Yeah.
We're not making – this shouldn't bother a good officer.
Right.
Because he's not rogue, or he or she's not rogue to begin with.
Yeah.
We're making the rules to get those who have the temptation – to skirt beyond where they should go. And that is just human nature. People tend to do things if they can get because they can. And we have to make sure they're given clear instructions on what they cannot do so they're not tempted to do what they cannot do.
So that was my asshole of the week. And then this is the asshole rule of the week. I don't know. Attorney General William Barr orders first federal executions in nearly two decades. So we haven't federally executed any prisoners since 2005 or 2003, I think it is. And now we're going to fire Sparky back up or whatever mechanism we're going to use. I'm not a fan of this plan. I don't like this.
So, well, I would say that there's my position has been pretty clear, and I'll restate it. I'm not a supporter of the death penalty. At once I was. But it is on the books. these sentences have been handed down, and he certainly says that he's doing his job, what he put his hand on the Bible to do, and these people have death sentences, and he's going to carry out his responsibility. So if you don't like the death penalty, then I think it's incumbent upon us as citizens to express that view to the United States Congress and repeal the death penalty.
I was speaking to a friend of mine last night, and he said, you know, so these are probably going to be some of the most heinous people in our society at the moment. And then, so this, like, very few people would object to this action for these people. But then the line will start creeping backwards until you end up with jaywalking as an execution offense. And yes, I'm being exaggeration. I know, but.
I can creep back that far. But I mean, it is on the books, and the courts impose these sentences. And like I said, I've tried to make it clear. So I'm not a fan of the death penalty anymore, but you certainly can't say that he has no basis because he didn't impose the death penalty.
Yeah. We the people did it.
We the people did it. We gave that tool to the court as a possible penalty. We gave that tool to the jury, and it's been imposed through the due process, and you can't be deprived of life and liberty or property without due process. They've had due process,
right.
And these are the people who their appeals have exhausted. And I think our state has a person who was convicted from our state. It's going to be number two on the list. I saw the list the other day. I think we've got someone who's going to be the number two person on the list of executions.
Hmm.
So he's doing his job.
Yay!
There'll be a lot of folks out there who will say that he's doing what he was like to do, and the president supported the death penalty, and the president made no bones about it when he ran. So you can't be mad at the president. He didn't say he's not being wishy-washy. He was opposed to the death penalty in his campaign. I mean, he was a supporter, excuse me.
Sure.
He was not opposed to the death penalty.
Well, then moving over to thephillyvoice.com. This Larry Krasner is like we should almost get him to be a guest on the podcast because he comes on here so often. And so I think this is pointing out, I think this is the one that has a whole bunch of, yeah, there's like a two dozen Philadelphia academics that are citing that he's doing the right thing, that the news is reporting his criminal justice reform efforts inaccurately. Crime hasn't risen, shootings aren't up, but the legislature is trying to squelch his ability to try and affect these changes in Philadelphia.
Well, they did squelch his ability. They bestowed on the state attorney general prosecutorial powers for they have dual powers now over a significant number of offenses that his office was declining to prosecute. So they have moved from where they claim that locals know best. They've decided that locals don't know best because we don't agree with the locals and who they chose and their screening of cases and their prioritization. So we're going to move it to the state level. So that's exactly what they have done.
Isn't that the point of carving out the individual jurisdictions so that the people can vote for the ones that they want to represent them most bestest?
Well, and I'm being a smart aleck here because generally conservatives claim that they defer to local because the local government is closest to the people and knows best. This is a real-time example of the hypocrisy of that because they defer to the locals on the things they agree with the locals on. But you let a local government impose a minimum wage that's higher than the state or federal minimum wage in a state where they have control, and watch how quickly they come in with state preemption. They magically don't believe in local control. Well, this is an example in real time of the legislature not agreeing with the local priorities in Philadelphia, so they're going to make sure that prosecutions continue.
Do you think that how do I want to word this? Then, so the legislature obviously is voted by Pennsylvania at large. Does Philadelphia then figure out how to spread that this is what they want? Be damned the state level stuff for trying to interfere?
Well, I don't know how they would undo that because the governor signed the legislation. So I don't know how if they were unable to stop it. If the majority of the lawmakers elected outside of, I'm assuming that even some in Philadelphia may have been for it. Some of the lawmakers that represent that part, because I'm not assuming for a moment that Philadelphia is in complete unison agreement on what Krasner is doing, but trying to undo this is going to be very difficult.
Hmm.
the only way to be undone would be if there's some judicial intervention where they decide that what the state did is unconstitutional. And that would be where I would go first, is I would go to the courts and see if there's any way that you could say that this is a trampling on the Constitution, and that if you can't win in court, then you got to go back to the public opinion. But the court may be able to be where they. I just don't know enough about Philadelphia Constitution law to know if it's a viable challenge. But you certainly look at it.
I assume you're referring to at the state level. That's not federal.
No, this will be something that will be entirely up to the state.
Okay.
The legislature in Pennsylvania passed the law giving dual prosecution to the state on a list of crimes. That may or may not be constitutional. It's presumed constitutional until there's a challenge. It may be that there's enough case law out there that I know, for example, like the sex offender registration scheme, that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania ruled that it was completely preempted by state control. So I would assume that there might be some avenue for a constitutional challenge. But if not, then the only way they would undo it would be to get the majority of the legislature to undo it and get another governor to sign that. That's going to be a tough sell. That's going to be a really tough sell, because it was going to turn loose a tidal wave of crime. Once the prosecutor, once the attorney general has those powers, he or she is not going to want to give those powers up.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you're going to have another law enforcement apparatus saying, well, if we don't have these powers, these people will go unpunished and you'll be less safe. So it's going to be very hard to politically remove this now that these powers, that, you know, I just don't see the political process yielding the result.
And then finally,
that's your problem. That's your problem. You're always so negative about everything, Larry. Why? I mean, that's the reason why this advocacy never moves forward, because everything comes up. You always say, "Nope, that won't work. That won't work." What's wrong with you,
Larry? You know, I don't want to blow smoke up your tushy. I don't want to like inflate your head so you can't walk through the door. But I heard someone say once that New Mexico has not had any meaningful registrant policies enacted, whatever, in the time that you guys have existed. So I'm going to make the assumption that the person driving that bus is you predominantly, because of your relationships, because of the way that you work in that system. We have all of these other people out there saying that, no, this should work this way, this should work that way. And I'm not seeing necessarily those kind of results. You know, we cover articles from almost every other state, and on an incredibly rare occasion, New Mexico pops up. I don't know if I'm evaluating that right, but that's what I take away from this.
Well, we've been very, very fortunate. I wouldn't say luck, but very fortunate. We've had good relations. We've had good success. And it has been accurately reported. We have not had anything that we didn't approve of go through in over a decade of our work. The two bills that the governor signed, we approved of them. But anything that has gone through the process here has gone through us saying that we're part of that process, and it's the only way to do it. If you think that people just want to write a great bill for the registrants, compromise is where it's at. You're not gonna get a beautiful bill that does great things for the offender population. Only if society felt that way, if society was ready to repudiate our punitive policies, and there was an overwhelming demand for change, but there isn't. There's the underlings of a little bit of a stir for change for lower level offenders, but sex offenders are way, way outside that scope,
right,
where that change, where that desire for change is. So it's going to be some time before there's radical change. But you keep working. In the meantime, you don't let things get worse.
Right. Right. Yeah. Draw a line in the sand and hold the line.
Absolutely. You have to hold the line. And that's progress, because if you don't hold the line, Arkansas didn't succeed in holding the line, did they?
Doesn't seem like it.
Yeah. So that they've got a new requirement that they didn't have last year.
Yeah.
And well, I would think that now that they have that new requirement, and that's not the only thing that's been posted in Arkansas recently, but since they didn't hold the line, I would think they would want to look at our model and try to figure out how to hold the line if you can't advance legislation, because holding the line keeps things from getting worse. And if the registry is as bad as we say it is, we certainly wouldn't want it to get any worse, would we?
Worser. No, we don't want worser. Larry, we are running so far over time. I really, really, really want to cover this article. So we got like 2 or 3 minutes to cover it. This is a federal suit challenges sex offender registry. This is something Moberly Monitor Index. No idea what this publication is. But the children of many of the 25 John and Jane Does seeking removal have also joined as plaintiffs in a lawsuit filed recently in the U.S. District Court. They're suing because they are the families of registrants of our people, and they say, you guys are treating my family like shit, so I want my life back. I want my parent back to be involved in my life, and, you know, whether that involves more kids, you know, grandkids, whatever. This seems to be a ridiculously effective strategy. To me, it seems like this would be the way to go, because these are collateral damage people that are damaged by all this bullshit.
I have not read the complaint. I believe you're talking about the Missouri case.
I believe that's right.
Yes. Our sister organization,
yes,
Women Against Registry.
Yep.
And I have not. It's 68 pages, I believe, the complaint.
Get on that.
So we can talk more about it hopefully next week. But I think anything that brings the horrors of how it goes beyond the registrant, with horrors for the registrants are bad enough. But when you can bring in the families, that's a viable strategy until it's not. So if the courts poo-poo it, then we'll, but right now I think that's everything else being equal, I think this is a good strategy, and I'm glad to see them doing it, and I support them in any way possible, and hopefully we can talk about it in more detail in the next episode.
Outstanding. Yeah, you got to get on those 60-something pages with your highlighter.
That's right. So,
Larry,
how do we get this podcast to surge in numbers? And did it surge in the last week?
We had more numbers for sure. They were kind of scattered around. We got a lot of activity on Twitter because Andrew Torres retweeted that he was on the show. So it went, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people potentially that didn't know we existed saw it. So yeah, there were some improved numbers for sure. Not as much as I would like, because I need you people, you that are listening. I need you to tell your buddies and your grandma and your grandpa and everyone. Tell them how to find it, which is at registrymatters.co. That's the website. That's how you can find us. If you want to call in and leave a voicemail, again, we haven't had any in a while. Charles did have a question, but we totally don't have time for it. But dial in at 747-227-4477. I also did thank the patrons tonight too. I will get to that. I will have a whole batch of them next time around too.
Well, we got a massive new patron that a couple of weeks ago, which was just so gratifying.
Absolutely. And then another one, a couple more inside of there too. And then, email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, Larry, how much do they give?
Well, all joking aside, I tell people the joke about your paycheck, but the way I look at it, $1 a month doesn't sound like much, but it really is, because think about the periodicals you subscribe to. Very few of them cost more than $30 a year, so that'd be like $2.50 a month. And I've when people give larger amounts, I'm gratified, and I'm even shocked that we provide that kind of value. But $1, $2 a month would be awesome.
Yep. So $1. I'd be perfectly happy with $1. And that's at patreon.com/registrymatters. And if you don't, if you are not inclined to do so, share it with everybody you know. Leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever else you get your stuff so that maybe more people will find us. That is the objective. Larry, I got nothing else. Anything else you want to say?
I think we've had a great podcast, and hopefully we can have Ashley back from time to time.
Sure. That'd be awesome. Have a great night, Larry. I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye.